Call the MTC Planning Committee meeting to order. Can the secretary confirm that we do have a quorum?
You do have a quorum.
Okay. I'd like to ask everyone to please join me in the pledge of our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, the compensation announcement. I just do want to make some connection here with some transportation issue. You'll entitled to receive $100 per meeting today to attend. And, you know, on this day in 1927, Charles Lindbergh got the Distinguished Flying Cross for going across the Atlantic. But I want you to know for that.
He got his $100.
But your $100 would have paid for all the fuel that he used to go across the Atlantic. And your this compensation, your $500 per month per agency, that would have paid for 5% of the cost of the airplane. So to show you that what you're making today. So I encourage all of you to take a trip across the Atlantic and try and do it in an airplane that carries one person. It's very fascinating that he carried no, letters or flags or anything. He actually stripped the plane where he didn't want a sheet of paper to take up 1 ounce of fuel. And so that's why he never carried anything that, commemorative or anything on that flight. It's very, very fascinating. And So with that, I thank all of you for being here. And with that, let's move on to consent calendar. These are items that require little or no discussion, and we only have the minutes of our May 9th meeting, and so I would entertain a motion.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any dissent? Hearing none, that motion passes unanimously. Ken, are you ready to do the Plan Bay Area implementation?
I am.
Review? Okay.
Good morning, commissioners. Today we just wanted to walk you through some of the efforts we have underway to implement Plan Bay Area. As you know, the plan is updated every 4 years. It's an ongoing work in progress, and there are a series of initiatives we have underway in partnership with other regional entities, with local jurisdictions, economic organizations in the region to advance implementation of the plan as well as its future update. This is related to supporting a vibrant economy for the region, linking housing, transportation, and economic development, and also planning for resilience related to climate adaptation and sea level rise. So the first item I'm going to touch on is something called the Vital Signs Performance Initiative.
One second.
Oh. I sit corrected. We're preparing to launch a performance monitoring effort known as Vital Signs later this fall. It will go beyond transportation to encompass land use, economic, and environmental measures in coordination with our regional partners. This is a dynamic web portal. This is different than a static report that is released. It'll focus on observed data from real-world sources, allowing us to better track regional progress as we prepare to launch the update of Plan Bay Area. So we'll be able to go back and look at how are we doing relative to what you've adopted, what does it mean for the future, and hopefully have something that's interesting both for casual observers in the region who care about what's going on and also for local policymakers and staff who are looking at these issues at not just a regional level but also at a local level. We'll be bringing this back to you later this year. The timeline is to launch later this fall and then do ongoing quarterly releases as we build the site. The next item is something called the Regional Economic Strategy Framework. You will recall that during the process of developing the plan, we heard a lot from the economic development community that we needed to do more on that front, and this effort is geared to do just that. Building on the Bay Area Economic Assessment Study, it's established to create a process to work with major regional business leaders. So leaders of companies in this region that, frankly, we don't hear from directly often here at the regional level. The Economic Institute will convene meetings with these folks and really try to work with them to identify industries and combinations of industries in geographic areas for potential growth in the region. Not just a one-size-fits-all, but looking at different counties, different sub-regions, what are the economic strategies for different parts of the region, to define proactive measures to support job growth opportunities, and to produce a framework that we can hopefully, at least to some extent, incorporate in the update of Plan Bay Area so that economic development has a more defined role and the business community has more of a voice in the update of the plan and really takes some ownership over the plan. The timeline for this is the kickoff is soon this summer, and it will be advancing through the winter of 2015. The next item is also related to economic development, and unfortunately it has a very similar name to the item I just described. The Economic Prosperity Strategy is a key component of the HUD-funded Bay Area Prosperity Plan. I think you're all aware that MTC and ABAG received a $5 million grant from HUD. The grant we received was somewhat different than most of the sustainable communities grants that HUD gave out to other regions in the country, in that it recognized that the Bay Area, even prior to Plan Bay Area, had a pretty significant regional planning framework. It also recognized that we have pretty significant issues of income inequality in the region, and that we were given funding to structure an approach that would help essentially lift all boats, to provide opportunities for lower and moderate income workers and residents. So the project goals for the economic prosperity strategy are to really move from the middle, to strengthen career pathways into middle wage jobs, to grow the economy with a focus on the middle, and upgrade conditions in existing low and moderate wage jobs. We'll be bringing this back to you later this year, along with other projects that are coming out of the HUD grant. I think what you'll find as this unfolds is that, you know, there are some items that we're likely to receive, some of the analysis that will likely be useful for MTC and ABAG to potentially incorporate it into Plan Bay Area. There are probably going to be studies and information that's presented that could be useful for another entity in the region to advance, but they just simply aren't in the wheelhouse of MTC. And there may be other efforts that, while interesting, aren't efforts that any entity in the region chooses to advance. It's a pretty complex approach. We think that one of the key tasks for staff is to make sure that the Bay Area Council Economic Institute work that I described previously in this work, that there's a good crosswalk between them, so we're not duplicating efforts and the two inform one another as we advance these efforts. We are developing a regional goods movement plan. I'm not going to spend much time on this because Carolyn Clevenger is going to describe it in more detail shortly. But this is really structured to look at the role of goods movement in the region, not just from a transportation perspective, but also from an economic development perspective. You know, I was just talking about very low-income, moderate-income workers in this region. Regional goods movement is a significant part of the region's economy, and it supports those types of jobs. It supports jobs that pay decent wages, that don't necessarily require a college degree. And the Regional Goods Movement Plan is looking at the complexity of our goods movement system, what it needs to be supported, and how it supports economic development in the region. So Carolyn will touch on that shortly. Soon after the plan adoption, you spent quite a bit of time looking at our transit needs in the region for our core capacity providers. I think everyone is well aware that we have some problems that are arguably good problems to have. We have a lot of housing growth. We have a lot of job growth in key corridors. And our trains and buses in the core of the region are increasingly crowded as a result. Although that's a good problem to have, it's a problem long-term if we don't deal with it. And with that in mind, we are partnering with BART, with SFMTA, with AC Transit on a study, as well as some other key transit providers that also serve the core of the region, to evaluate and prioritize short, medium, and long-term investments and strategies The focus is on the Transbay and Muni Metro corridors, but we're also looking at the Caltrain connection coming up from the peninsula, the ferry service to the city, how all of these systems fit together. And we'll be looking at them from the perspective of what are some of the service alignments that could happen in the short term, what are some of the infrastructure improvements that will be needed in the medium and long term to really provide the capacity for the growth that is in this plan. It's also our hope that this could inform local and regional measures in the future in bringing federal funding to the region to inform and support transit infrastructure as it's developed in the region. We have jointly applied for a Tiger grant. We're hoping we're going to get good news, but this will be moving forward whether or not we're successful on that grant request. The timeline is to kick off later this year and to wrap things up in advance of the adoption of Plan Bay Area. The parallel study that we're advancing in partnership with VTA is something called the Core Connectivity Transit Study. San Jose and the South Bay is also experiencing a lot of job and housing growth in key corridors. Many of them priority development areas. The South Bay is, of course, in a different place in the development of its transit network, and this study recognizes that. It's really structured to build off of existing transit planning work, to sync up the existing and future systems in the South Bay, and in particular to take a look at first and last mile transit connections, which are a very big issue in the South Bay related to office parks and how they connect to the existing bus and rail systems, and also how private shuttles serve those areas. The scope for this is still under development, but it has a similar timeline to the core capacity study. We look to kick it off later this year. We hope to wrap it up in about a year. Again, it's structured both to inform the update of Plan Bay Area and also future measures that could advance the implementation of our transit system. Transit systems in the South Bay. You may recall that during the plan, we did a feasibility study of the priority development areas. This was at the request of the business community. We did a small subset that really looked at entitlement processes, the level of community support for development in these areas, market strength, infrastructure capacity, and unfunded needs. We will be doing a more robust version of that called the PDA assessment to inform the update of the plan and the implementation of the plan. It's really to look at how are we doing in our priority development areas, what kind of infrastructure investments are needed, where is there community support, where might there be more community support in terms of permit streamlining and issues of that sort. This will kick off shortly this summer, and we're looking to wrap it up by the winter of 2015-2016. It will not look at every single priority development area, but it will be quite a bit more comprehensive than the first go-around on this front. At your workshop earlier this year, we talked about the issue of transit, transportation, transit-oriented development, and affordable housing, and the fact that with the loss of redevelopment, this is actually a really challenging time for the production of affordable housing. Even though the regional economy is doing quite well, and in some areas we have a lot of market rate housing under production, including in transit-oriented locations, there just isn't a lot of money to produce affordable housing. So one of the approaches that we would like to advance or at least assess is what is the capacity for developing affordable housing, looking at underutilized lands in key corridors that are served by rail. Places where we're putting a lot of investment in these transit systems, Caltrain, BART, SMART, looking not just at transit agency-owned land, but also just underutilized public lands. What are the opportunities to develop affordable housing in these locations in PDAs, in mixed-income, mixed-use neighborhoods? This work is going to be augmented with some funding that an organization or a group of organizations called Living Cities is providing. Living Cities has provided quite a bit of the funding for the TOD Affordable Housing Fund, and they would like to augment this work with some additional funding. So it will kick off this fall, and it will be completed, we hope, in the winter of 2015-2016. I think at MTC we all know that pricing is a powerful tool and it can also be pretty contentious. And when you bring that down to the local level, that kind of describes parking policy as well, as you all know better than I do. We received funding this year from FHWA to develop a value parking pricing project. It looks at parking policies across 25 different communities, most of them with PDAs. It will develop a new parking analysis tool that local staff, local electeds can use to consider how they might develop parking policies at the local level that might, for example, do what has occurred in the city of Berkeley, where they unbundled parking, looking at daytime and evening and nighttime uses across business and residential developments. We're better able to utilize parking, produce less parking, reduce the impact of parking on development costs. We're having a series of workshops with local staff. We'll provide funding to local staff or local cities that request it to develop pilot policies. We hope this is something we'll have a better handle on as a way to inform reducing vehicle miles traveled and supporting reducing the impacts of parking costs on development as we move forward with the plan. And this would look to wrap up in the summer of 2015. Finally, one of the issues that we touched on in Plan Bay Area, but we didn't take a deep dive, excuse the pun, is sea level rise. It's a big issue here. We have this big bay right in the middle of the region. And we are working with BCDC and other partners on something called the Adapting to Rising Tides Project. This looks at the Alameda County shoreline. It's the second phase of this effort. It takes a particular real close look at the Bay Bridge touchdown, the Oakland Airport, BART, and identifies local and sub-regional adaptation strategies for dealing with sea level rise in some of our particularly vulnerable areas. This is really a first look at this issue. This is going to be a bigger issue in the update of Plan Bay Area. We'll be bringing you more information, and a lot of it is going to be coming from BCDC. But this is to look at some of our most vulnerable transportation assets and what are some of the implementation measures that we need to take to plan for the future for these areas. So with that, I will stop there. I'm happy to try and answer any of your questions. And as I mentioned, Carolyn will be giving you an update on the goods movement plan shortly.
Alicia?
Going back to the last slide, I noticed most of the things that you're discussing on sea level rise have to do with Alameda County, and we know that San Mateo is probably going to be one of the most affected. Is there nothing on, or is that going to be on an update, or why wasn't that originally there?
So this is a pilot project that focused on Alameda County. It's geared to be sort of a first step at looking at one of the vulnerable areas. San Mateo shoreline is obviously a very vulnerable area as well.
Probably the most.
And so we're working with BCDC, and BCDC is looking at additional pilots, including the San Mateo and Santa Clara shorelines, and also are reaching out to the business community, which, as you know, has a lot of key real estate in some of these vulnerable areas on the peninsula and in the South Bay. So we will be bringing back more information in the future in terms of those efforts, and they're being considered.
So how were these chosen based on to do this one as a pilot study?
This was a joint effort to receive funding, and it involved Alameda County, BCDC. I think Carolyn is going to provide more detail.
About 2.5 years ago, we did a call for the first round pilot, and that was a call for counties to express interest in being the first round pilot. Alameda County had the most interest and had the most data available during that first round. So this second round pilot dug deeper into three transportation areas within it, and we utilized the analysis that had been done in the first round, which is why we focused on Alameda County again. But as Ken mentioned, the San Mateo County has the grant that was recently received to start bringing a lot of their data up to the level where this data was from the first pilot we did with FHWA.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Jake?
Not so much a question, but just to let people know that there will be an August 19th through 20th California Adaptation Forum in Sacramento, which is going to be a venue for all of us who are involved on the adaptation side to meet together and discuss options here in the state of California. And this is has grown out of the National Adaptation Forum of last year, and they're going to be alternating odd and even years, national California. So just wanted to remind people you can access it through the Local Government Commission's website. The registration is now open, and look forward to seeing some of us there. Thanks.
I'll just add, this project is going to be presented at the forum.
Amy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got a lot of work going on right now. This is really helpful to see the summary of all these studies, I think, that are going to be really important as we move forward on many fronts. And I just wanted to follow up on the summary with regards to the PDA development feasibility and readiness study. And just wondered if you, I know it's beginning this summer with the goal of having that completed by December. And I just wondered if you could refresh our memory in terms of kind of the scope and what the process will be in that study, both in terms of gathering information, you know, reaching out to the cities, to folks that are interested in providing the housing, and some of the issues that you're going to be looking at, and just to talk about how we can also help, you know, get the word out so we can get the kind of information that will be helpful to the to all those communities in the region.
Sure. So we'll be working with consultants to develop the list of the PDAs that will be examined. We're really going to try to have a good cross-section that's representative of the PDAs across the region. So some of them, there'll be geographic diversity, there'll be diversity in terms of market strength as understood by the consultants and by staff. The last time around, there were pretty extensive interviews, both with local staff as well as developers who are familiar with working in various communities. A number of issues were assessed in terms of looking in the short and longer term what the development strengths and challenges of these places were. Some of it looked at just, you know, what is the market likely to bear in the near term given what we know right now. So when this was done 2 years ago, the economy was weaker than it is now. Redevelopment was gone. And there was quite a disparity between different communities in terms of what was expected or likely for future development. We expect that that's probably evolved a bit, that some of the places that were seen as more struggling in the economic climate of a couple of years ago are likely stronger now. You know, I think it's really a snapshot of what the possible is, but it's also not definitive. Like any other planning study, it needs to be looked at as something that's a bit nuanced. For example, it cannot capture what happens in a given community after a series of investments have been made and there's some early development that you really have a tipping point. We all know neighborhoods in the region where 20 years ago no one could have imagined that they would be developing the way they are now because key investments were made and at some point the market in that community improved. The study can't really capture that, but what it can look at are what are the impediments to growth and what are the pieces being put in place to attract growth, what does it look like over the long term, and then we can look at that collectively in terms of where should we be investing, what are the infrastructure investments that need to be made, what are the planning supports that need to happen. And we will be coordinating with local staff and local jurisdictions, and we can coordinate with the commission as well to let you know what communities are being examined and so forth.
Can I just follow up? In that process, too, it might be helpful to look at some of the community-based planning processes that are in place as sort of models or best practices or what seems to be effective ways that communities are reaching out to their residents and engaging them in these kind of this planning process. So I'm wondering if are you going to be including some of that and kind of the
yes.
the analysis too? Okay.
It's a pretty thorough examination of what the local jurisdictions are doing, including the outreach process and what plans have been put in place and so forth.
Alicia?
Is there an incentive for cities or areas that have really moved and worked on those PDAs and have built all along the transit corridor in this plan?
Well, I mean, this is an assessment. It's a study, so there's not an incentive per se. I think, you know, communities that have done that and are seeing the development happen, they certainly look strong in the assessment. There's no direct link between the assessment and funding. But it is a snapshot, and it really does tend to show where more work is needed and where things are well underway.
And the last question that I have, this living communities funding, when is it going to be available, and how is that going to come out?
I would have to get back to you on that. I don't know the exact timeline. They announced that they would, you know, be providing some funding a few months ago, but we can get that information back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, as we go forward with a lot of these strategies, partnerships and investments in other things and transportation like housing, what is staff thinking about? How are we going to measure our success, or how are we measuring? Are we making progress? Is this the best place to put that investment?
And you're speaking of the PDA assessment?
Well, I'm thinking of all of these things that we're doing. You're talking about these partnerships with ACE and BART, and you know, we're investing money into housing. I mean, at some point, we're going to have to do some type of measure of whether we're being successful. Is this the right place to put the money? Are we getting this mode shift that we hope we would get? I mean, what is staff thinking about how we're going to measure that? And this is more of a, I think, something we're going to have to take a closer look at probably a year or so from now.
What you've described is in part what the Vital Signs performance effort is about, is really trying to have a more robust, more comprehensive look at how is the region doing on a variety of measures, looking at how we're doing in terms of our own performance objectives, but also how is the region performing economically, where is growth happening, how are we doing in terms of transit ridership, what systems are picking up more transit ridership, how does it relate to these investments. We're going to need to look at those performance measures, I think, over time. I think we feel that we need to be a little bit cautious in terms of not reading too much into anything too quickly with a long-range plan. I mean, a lot of the infrastructure investments take time to really bear results. The same is true with some of the investments in the PDAs, and certainly on the planning side, these are, even at the local level, these are long-range plans. But as we look for the update of the plan, which we will be bringing to you next month, a potential schedule for that, I think this is one of the issues that we'll want to be talking to you more about as we move forward toward updating the plan. What changes might there be in terms of performance measures? What do those mean for the short and long term? How does it inform future investments and what's included in the plan in terms of our strategies and priorities?
You know, what I'd like to suggest that we do is we look at and measure these strategies is that we drill down a little bit deeper and we look at actual communities, we actually look at projects. You know, we seem to always take this global view or this regional view and say, oh, the numbers are good, but there's a lot of areas we're not having those successes. And so I think we need to look at that. And, you know, where we're these established the communities with access to public transit, you know, and we're talking about growth around those. You know, are we really moving people into transit? And, you know, those are the types of things that I want to make sure that we're measuring and seeing, are we getting this mode shift? And the other issue that you raise, you know, there's starting to be a lot of housing development, and there's very little of it is affordable housing. Is that new movement, are they going to absorb the potential affordable housing sites? I mean, is somebody monitoring that? Is there an inventory of those potential sites? And are they being, you know, absorbed in?
That's one of the key concerns. If you talk with affordable housing providers, many of them will say it's sort of the perfect storm right now for them, because not only did they lose affordable housing funding related to redevelopment, but the market demand in some areas, many areas, is so strong that the sites that they may have been able to attain, they don't have a prayer of getting those sites because they're so expensive now. And that's part of what the study looking at underutilized public lands is about, is are there opportunities to utilize some of those sites which are already publicly held and are closely associated with rail stations?
Yeah, I think we really need to look at doing an inventory of where those potential opportunities are in those transportation corridors or whatever the mode is. And I think that we ought to be measuring that, because that can be a major problem in the future if we don't capture some of that for affordable housing. So, okay, is there any other? Rich Hedges. Rich, you want to speak on this item? Or?
Very interesting discussion. The comment about measuring whether TODs are working or not actually prompted me to give you my most recent experience. I took a tour with Universal Paragon of the Mission Bay development, which I went on a tour in 1985 when it was just being imaged as to what would be built there. It's kind of interesting to look back over those years and see what's actually happened, and it's happened pretty much as was expected. But I wanted to speak about Bay Meadows, since I was so invested in that. If you'd have lived my life at that time, you'd realized how many rotten editorials were written about my effort to try to get Bay Meadows built, because I chaired the committee that pushed it through. But we just recently, on this Universal Paragon tour, went through Bay Meadows. The point I really want to make is that not only from the people who are administrating the program there, but from local residents that we interviewed, 60% of the people moving in there so far are taking the train to work. What's happening is these developments are beginning to self-select for people who want to ride transit. When we first started on this journey of TOD, I've been around a while, we were hopeful that we'd get our trip savings through the local services that were set up within these developments of about 50% and 25% for work-related trips. We're at a stage now with Bay Meadows where there's construction everywhere. People have to walk out of their way to get to the train, and they're still going to the train. So I think it's working based on that anecdotal experience with one pretty large development. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Okay, anything else? Anyone else? Okay, let's move on to the next slide. Oh, I'm sorry, Tom, I couldn't see your light.
So, Ken, I'm wondering, on the PDAs, I know when is the next round for people to be able to apply for PDAs?
We'll get back to you with the specific information. My understanding is right now ABAG has an open call for new PDAs. I believe it is running through the middle part of next year.
Okay.
But we'll get that information and send it back to all of you.
Okay.
I believe there's an open call right now.
Oh,
and
there
it's
is.
Oh, it's
great.
Going for several months.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yes, Mark.
Well, you hear this every time I'm here, but it's a good story. We've got five new low to moderate income homeowners in our work proximity housing program in Napa this last month. And the program just continues to grow. And it seems, in this time when land is expensive and construction is really difficult, we've had two projects in Napa which have basically fallen apart because of CEQA lawsuits. And so millions of dollars were tied up for years trying to get those projects through, and now they're not happening. We've invested about $1.5 million in this program. We have 45 homeowners as a result, and the program grows. I just don't see anything in your planning effort that looks at that type of approach. I mean, we still seem to be doing the same old thing, which is let's figure out how to take really expensive property and build affordable housing on it. And I just don't think that model works. And I guess I keep knocking on the door saying, we all need to take a bigger look at what we're doing here and how we can get people into affordability without bumping our heads against the same wall. So somewhere along these planning efforts, I'd like to see this alternative approach considered. If we could take that multi-million dollar property and sell it, we could fund another few hundred work proximity homeowners. And so anyway, I just want to like to see that sort of evaluated at some point. It's a great Napa experience, but I think it works throughout the Bay Area. It's tied directly to vehicle miles reduced by the fact that you have to live within a certain number of miles of where you work in order to qualify.
Thank you. We'll follow up with you.
That's a good suggestion. Okay.
I'm going to follow up on that and the same thing that the chair mentioned. There's an example of low-income housing that has worked on a campus in San Mateo County where the Community College District built low-income housing for their staff and faculty, both at the College of San Mateo and Kenyatta College. And even though it was a huge investment and folks can live there for 3 years and then they save up money to buy a home, after about 5 years of being invested in this type of housing, the revenue is starting to come in. Now they're beginning to make a profit. Initially, they're not. We got a letter from Jackie Spear in San Mateo County saying, look at housing it that way. You know, as far as businesses being able to, whether it's school districts or cities, being able to build the housing for the folks that are living there in areas. I'm kind of getting tired of hearing the excuse of we lost redevelopment funds and so therefore we can't do housing. And if each of us looked at our cities and looked at what did you do when you had redevelopment funds for low-income housing, it's very low. So now we're using it as an excuse to say now we can't build it. So I think I agree with what's being said is we have to look at all alternatives, and I'd like to see more of that in the plans as we go to the future.
Well, that's just an excellent point, because that's part of why they went after redevelopment. That money wasn't being spent. That set aside was being used. It was being leveraged for other things, but that's a great point. Any other comments?
I just wanted to follow up on several of the comments relative to the availability of lands to do the kind of provide the housing that we need for the future. And I just wanted to focus on the additional study you're talking about, which ties in with Commissioner Geary's comments about using public lands for housing development. And, you know, I know that there are a lot of barriers to doing that, mostly by the public agencies. And so I wondered if you, you know, and I think that the model of building housing on a community college campus is an incredible example of the type of development that is so beneficial to local community, the strength of the community college, all those great things, and particularly in the academic world, the lack of available housing that faculty can afford. So I guess that would be one of the things that I think, too, would be to look at this study as being particularly important, looking at those not only along corridors, but really along in public lands, because a lot of time those campuses are tied to public transit. It may not be rail. It may be a regular, you know, bus service and that kind of thing. So I know that between a lot of these public agencies, we may be able to find those resources. And a lot of communities, that's how they're able to build affordable housing projects, is taking existing public land and utilizing it. So I see in lieu of, you know, since land costs are one of the highest elements in production, would be really to look at this and how and whether it's legislative changes or the kinds of things that we would need to do to be able to provide those lands. So thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to Sam. Oh, Sam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note, you know, we're all looking for sources of funding for affordable housing. It's not easy. And it's not going to get easy anytime soon. But I think it's important we keep in mind, you know, it was only a month ago that there was considerable opposition to the idea of us funding an impact study for a single jurisdiction that wanted to assess whether a nexus study, rather, to assess whether or not an impact fee would be an appropriate means for their jurisdiction to generate the funding necessary to create affordable housing. And there are very strong feelings about whether or not that was an appropriate method or not. I think the studies, frankly, are pretty equivocal on this issue, and frankly, there's a lot more study to be done. But it seems to me, at the very least, we need to continue to allow jurisdictions to explore options like impact fees. Obviously, when the state Supreme Court rules, as I hope they will in the next couple of months, on inclusionary, we need to be a little more open-minded about these options because, frankly, the money's not going to fall from the sky.
Yeah, I just, you know, Sam, your portrayal of that, I don't know, I totally disagree. You know, I think it is an appropriate expense. I think there ought to be, one of the things that I was asking for is why isn't there some matching funds? I mean, we can't, if a jurisdiction wants to do it, let's set up a program to where we can encourage, but they have some investment in it too. And so those are some of the things that we were concerned about. And, you know, it just didn't seem like we had any criteria of what we were looking for out of that. And so it's not a matter of is it good to do those studies. It's just a matter of how can we maximize that investment? Can we get more people to do it? Can they pay their fair share or some share of it? I just think that it's one of those things that we're screaming for money for both capital and operating, that we really ought to look at how we invest all of our dollars. And that was the criticism. It's not that it wasn't a good idea.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond. I don't dispute those are all reasonable questions to ask in the context of whether an impact fee is an appropriate policy or not. But I recall the question was simply whether or not we were going to fund a nexus study in an individual jurisdiction to enable them to establish the nexus, which would enable them to even get to the point of being able to assess whether or not a policy would be appropriate in combination with other policies. And so I think we need to be able to allow jurisdictions and facilitate their efforts to look for ways to be able to do this, because the money is not going to come from Sacramento or from Washington, D.C. We're seeing all those sources dry up. And so I think we need a more flexible approach that allows jurisdictions to experiment and understand and study what does work and what doesn't.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Just one quick thing. You know, in the area of affordable housing, you know, a lot of the counties have gotten, you know, what's been referred to as boomerang funds, and I believe San Mateo has put a great chunk of their money towards affordable housing, as is Alameda County on the brink of doing the same. And I would say that as we approach affordable housing and how we fund it in the future, maybe it should be based on, you know, what kind of match is coming from the counties that have actually dedicated boomerang funds towards affordable housing. I think it's just something we should think about, because it's not like the counties aren't getting any money coming back. In fact, they are. And some are choosing not to do anything with affordable housing. But I think most are. And I think some sort of matching grant to reward those that are using the boomerang funds for affordable housing would be appropriate.
All right. Let's move on to item number 6. Carolyn, are you ready? This is the draft regional good movements plan.
Great. Good morning, Commissioners. Carolyn Clevenger with MTC Planning. And with me today is Michael Fisher, who's our consultant leading the goods movement update from Cambridge Systematics. As we mentioned in March, this committee, MTC, is initiating an update to our regional goods movement plan. We're doing this in close collaboration with Alameda County Transportation Commission, which is also doing a detailed countywide goods movement plan. And Tess Lingell, their deputy director, is here with us today as well. We are also coordinating with all of the counties across the region, so we I know we're already on the agenda for Contra Costa and Solano counties to come and present to their boards and have made the offer to all the counties. And we're providing a lot of the data that you'll see here today at the county level over the next probably month or so, and then hopefully at the corridor level over the next about 3 to 5 months. Today we're going to give you an update on some of the data collection that's been underway. You will see some of that's linked back to the economic development and workforce material that Ken mentioned briefly today, and we'll be continuing to dig into that issue as the plan progresses. We are still at the beginnings of the plan. We'll also review some of the trends, issues, and opportunities we've started to hear. We've been doing stakeholder meetings for about 3 to 4 months now, so we've met with a number of different groups, from businesses to labor to you know, development and chambers of commerce type committees to communities and public health. And we're continuing to do meetings over the course of this project. We're doing focus groups with a number of different stakeholders. And we're also going to go over a quick review at the end of the vision and goals that have been developed for the project. You'll see a slight revision to some of that material based on some feedback received earlier this week from Alameda County's Transportation Commission. And that focused on really trying to highlight more closely the benefits of job creation related to goods movement, as well as bringing up in the way we presented the goals, the goal of reducing impacts on communities. So that's just a quick overview of what you'll hear today. And then also we will be sending out, just so all of you are aware, on July 23rd, we're going to be doing a kickoff roundtable event, a public event, that you should all be receiving some save the dates for in your emails either later today or Monday. With that, I'll turn it over to Michael.
Thank you. So I'd like to just start by touching on why should we be concerned about goods movement in the region. As we've mentioned and you all are aware, goods movement is a pretty critical part of the region's economy. Over $600 billion of goods flow within or through our region each year. A lot of high-value products. I'll show you a bit of a profile of what that looks like in a minute. And roughly 32% of jobs in the region are in what we would call goods movement dependent industries. These are the industries that really generate the largest amount of spending on goods movement services. The goods movement service providers are themselves a key source of job diversity. They provide jobs that require lower levels of educational attainment than some other of the jobs that are predominant in our economy. So they are very important to supporting diversity in our economy. Our goods movement system is heavily reliant on transportation, and our system here in the Bay Area provides some critical roles nationally as well as to the state. We have the nation's fifth largest marine port, two major airports that provide international and domestic air cargo service. We have some of the busiest goods movement highways and rail corridors in the state and in the nation. And we have a local street and road system, which is increasingly being called upon to deliver urban goods movement services and last mile deliveries to our retail, commercial, and residential centers. We also know that goods movement is a significant source of public health and quality of life impacts on local communities, and anything we do to improve the goods movement system needs to address those impacts directly, either as part of the projects themselves or as mitigations as we move forward. So that's kind of why we're doing this effort. Just to give you a little bit of a flavor of what we're finding, right now we're completing what we call our baseline assessment, pulling together a lot of the existing information before we do more in-depth analysis to try to identify what are some of the critical trends and issues and opportunities that exist in, throughout the region that will be the focus of greater analysis later in the study. And this shows you sort of a snapshot of some of that information. This is looking at data that's compiled at the federal level for the region as a whole. And one of the couple things I'd like to point out about this is that goods movement that involves what we call just strictly domestic trade, movements that stay within the U.S. or within the region, are the largest share of goods movement in our region. That's not uncommon, and they will remain so over the next 30 years. But the fastest growing component of our goods movement in the region is in international trade, and in fact, export growth is projected to be the highest level of growth in goods movement activity, which makes our region somewhat unique as compared to other regions in the state and in the nation, and it's something we think is going to be important to focus on. How do we facilitate that trade and the benefits that it brings? This is a look at all of the different types of products and commodities that move in the region. This includes domestic and international trade, things that are produced and shipped out of the region, as well as supplies and consumer goods that come in. And one of the major characteristics I want to point out about this region, again, that are somewhat unique from other parts of the country, is the high-value nature of a lot of the products that are produced here that really represent the types of industries that we all know exist in the region. I guess I'd also like to point out that they represent the diversity of our regional economy. We use a classification system here that's adopted by the federal government, but if we were to group some of these commodities slightly differently, one of the things that we would find is right after electronics and machinery, petroleum products are very high value. They would be number three if we pooled them all together, and food and ag products, particularly imports that are or exports that are coming through our region from the Central Valley, would be number four. So this gives you sort of a picture of what's driving goods movement demand. As I mentioned, about a third of the jobs in the region are in these goods movement dependent industries, and you can see what we're classifying as goods movement dependent industries here. And about a third of those are in the manufacturing sector. So even though we may not think of our region as still having a vital manufacturing center, it's still contributing a lot of growth to goods movement. And even though employment may be relatively flat in this sector over in the future, increases in productivity, advanced manufacturing processes are all going to increase the amount of goods that need to be transported. And then there are these other sectors that contribute more to our population-supporting industries that are clearly an important component of our goods movement activity. I'd like to just summarize some of the key trends and issues and strategies that we're going to be focusing on, because this really is the setup for what our vision and goals are. And a lot of what I'm going to present to you now comes from outreach that we've done to stakeholders. As Carolyn mentioned, we've talked to a lot of people so far, and we continue to reach out more broadly across the region to business groups, to community groups, to environmental groups, and to goods movement service providers to really get a sense of what they're thinking we ought to be focusing on in the plan, and then trying to support that with the information and data that we've been collecting. So what are we hearing from folks? One is that we really need to plan our goods movement system to keep pace with economic trends and to attract investment into this region to take advantage of the goods movement opportunities that exist out there and ensure that that job diversity that I talked about really comes to our region and that we get the benefits of this economic activity. We hear that the Port of Oakland is a great asset, but there are significant improvements that are needed in rail service, in supporting warehousing and terminal capacity, and capacity and efficiency improvements to support the potential growth that can occur there. We hear a lot about local truck routes and what's going on city streets and how do we coordinate what we're doing with our complete streets policy and make sure that on those, particularly in those arterial corridors where we're sharing capacity with passenger users and other modes, that we do at least consider the needs of freight, but that we try to reduce conflicts and take advantage of synergies. We hear a lot about jobs equity and community participation needs. We see opportunities to apply new and innovative technologies and to approach innovative funding and financing opportunities, particularly a lot of interest in public-private partnership opportunities because so much of the goods movement system involves private ownership. Again, public health and safety are major issues. We as we're planning for growth, we need to make sure that our strategies address these concerns and needs. We hear a lot from the cities about pavement maintenance issues, spillover of congestion onto local streets, and how do we ensure that our arterial corridors are equipped to handle that. We see in the future increased congestion on shared use multimodal corridors, so both our highway corridors and our rail corridors, concerns about land use conflicts, particularly in industrial corridors, where we're starting to focus a lot of our future residential commercial development as well as industrial development, and a lot about truck parking, truck route, and other types of community impact issues. So that's sort of the backdrop upon which we've developed our regional goods movement goals and vision. This is just a sort of an idea of some of the types of strategies that we're going to be looking at. And I'm not going to go into these in too much detail in the interest of time, but I want to point out that we're looking at a pretty wide range of different types of strategies that include investments in capacity, that include new approaches to operations and application of technology, looking at our interregional corridors as well as our local street system, developing land use guidance and truck route planning, truck operations guidance, as well as more focused strategies looking at new emission control technologies, financial incentives for adopting new operating practices, and ways of reducing impacts. So based on all of that, we have developed a vision statement and goals for our plan that we believe are reflect those issues and opportunities, and that also are consistent with the The goals and vision that have been adopted in Plan Bay Area for the Regional Transportation Plan and that are consistent in the planning work that we're doing, in the more focused planning work we're doing in Alameda County with what we're proposing to address in the regional work. So I'll just go through these quickly. I just covered this material, so let me just move on to the vision itself. The vision statement is that the goods movement system will be safe and efficient, provide seamless connections to international and domestic markets to enhance economic competitiveness, create jobs, and promote innovation while reducing environmental impacts and improving local communities' quality of life. I think that highlights all the key things that we really want to see the goods movement system provide, the safety and efficiency issues, the connectivity issues, both in terms of our connectivity to markets, but also our connectivity across modes, our focus on economic competitiveness and job creation, and our concern about quality of life. We've developed five specific goal statements that'll guide our planning efforts, and I'll go through each one of these. First, and these are not necessarily presented in any priority order, but they're all critically important. We want to increase economic growth and prosperity that supports communities and business. So it's this twin idea of economic growth and economic competitiveness, but making sure that, that those economic benefits are delivered to our communities here in the region. Next, we want to reduce environmental and community impacts from goods movement operations to create healthy communities, a clean environment, and improve quality of life for those communities most affected by goods movement. We want to improve quality of life for everybody, but this goal really does recognize the fact that we know that there are particular communities throughout our region that are bearing perhaps a disproportionate level of impact from goods movement activity, and we need to be very sensitive to that and ensure that the strategies we adopt address those impacts. We want to provide safe, reliable, efficient, and well-maintained goods movement facilities. Safety and reliability certainly are key concerns. We've heard over and over again, as I said, from cities how critical it is that we look at ways of providing the funding and the resources to address maintenance of facilities that are impacted by goods movement activity. We want to promote innovative technology strategies to improve the efficiency of the goods movement system. We believe that innovation is really a hallmark of the Bay Area economy, and there ought to be ways of involving our innovative tech sectors and our innovative policy institutes in helping us develop really innovative approaches. This is something that is a focus in the goals and vision that are being adopted at the state level in the state's freight mobility plan, as well as in the federal national freight policy planning efforts. And finally, we want to preserve and strengthen an integrated and connected multimodal goods movement system that supports freight mobility and access and is coordinated with passenger transportation systems and local land use decisions. And I want to really kind of highlight this last point here because increasingly we're using shared use corridors, as I mentioned earlier, and as we plan in these shared use corridors, we need to ensure that we're doing that in a way that takes account for all of the different users of our shared use corridors. And also we need to understand and we need to appreciate the importance of local land use decisions and planning. Some of the problems and conflicts we believe can be addressed through better guidance on how to deal with buffers or where goods movement oriented uses abut residential and commercial uses and to plan those facilities in ways that more effectively eliminate conflicts. So just to wrap up and then take any questions you might have, As I mentioned, we're completing our baseline assessment work. We should be completed with that at the regional level within about a month or so from now. There are a number of reports and technical memos that we'll be preparing that will provide information about what's going on in the regional goods movement system today. As Carolyn mentioned, the kickoff roundtable is going to be occurring on the 23rd of July, and that will be happening over at the Alameda CTC offices. We're really hoping that this is going to be a well-attended event, really to bring people throughout the region together to talk about how do we focus our efforts so that we ensure that as we're developing this plan, we have a collaboration that can move ideas and policies forward, not just within the region, but at the state and the national level, where we know we need partners to accomplish these goals. We're finalizing our vision and goals through the review and comment that we're getting from groups like yours. And then we're finalizing strategy identification and evaluation methodology. We've been working very hard on developing performance measures and a process for evaluating projects, policies, and strategies. And then we'll be, over the summer and into the fall, conducting a more detailed needs assessment that will really be drilling down into what are some of the issues that we've been covering in the baseline assessment and providing greater documentation with data analysis and further outreach to the groups that we've been talking to. So that concludes my presentation, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
Carolyn, can you just comment a little bit on the project organization? You got the executive team, you got the partnership technical advisory group. Does there seem to be a consensus on the direction we're going?
Yeah, so the we do have this executive management team that's composed of MTC, Caltrans District 4, ACTC, the Port of Oakland. We also have Contra Costa Transportation Authority, Solano Transportation Authority, and Santa Clara VTA on that, as well as the Air District and East Bay Economic Development Agency. So it's public agency directors who are really dedicating staff resources to moving the regional goods movement work forward. And we're meeting them about quarterly to get strategic guidance as we go. And then on the regional side, we're using our Partnership Technical Advisory Committee as the official TAC for the group. We are also meeting with the CMA planning directors and executive directors throughout the project to get detailed input from them. And as Michael mentioned, we've been doing stakeholder focus group meetings. We're doing those throughout the course of the project. So we've had a number of meetings with different stakeholder groups, and we will continue doing those focus groups, as well as bringing everyone together in these roundtables. We're doing 6 roundtables over the course of the project, both to just generate interest throughout the region and to try and build future advocacy sort of connections and trying to get people excited about trying to advance some of the goods movement initiatives within the region. So those are the major sort of organizational structures we have for it. And then also at the county level for Alameda County, they have their own advisory structure since they're moving on their own countywide goods movement plan. We are making sure that the vision and goals are consistent across the two because we think it's really important that we have, you know, a strong unified voice for advocacy in the region.
I guess just to address your question about consensus, I think at this point the kinds of issues that I presented to you today, I think there is pretty broad consensus in all the groups that we've talked to that those are the right issues. Of course, I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about what are the most appropriate and priority strategies that we ought to be adopting, but so far I think we're all pretty much in agreement on what we need to focus on.
Yeah, I think the organization structure and the stakeholder outreach is very impressive. You know, I think that you've thrown a broad net. And so, very, very impressive.
Scott? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, one of the things that I believe is missing here, when you look at the goods movement strategies and you talk about the things you can do to make it better, I think clearly, and I know it's implied, but I really think we should specifically call out 24-hour port. And the reason for that is that would tremendously help our problem. If we could move those trucks to the nighttime and they're not competing with people that are trying to get to work, and, you know, and clearly I think the trucks would want to do it too because they're not sitting in traffic. So I just really think we should call that out as a strategy and really dig deeply into that and see if it's possible to work with the longshoremen and the port and everybody else to see if it's possible to move this truck traffic that's during the day to the nighttime.
David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I do agree that very impressive framework presentation. I had a question about going back to the vision and goals and looking at vision, the first vision goal, talking about the increased economic growth, and then connecting that to the second vision goal of reducing the impact on communities that are disproportionately impacted. I'm wondering if, as part of the strategy, is there a way to connect the two so that there is economic growth and economic benefit, especially in those communities that are being disproportionately impacted by the goods and movements?
Definitely there is. And in fact, one of the very first stakeholder outreach meetings that we had was with the Alameda Labor Council, and then with a follow-up with some of the local IWU unions in San Francisco. And this whole idea of workforce development was really kind of front and center, obviously, in those discussions. And we really do think there are some opportunities to link the two ideas together. I think what we are hoping to get greater insight in, and we've just started to compile some of this data, are what are some of the occupational categories that really show some promise within logistics sectors, and how do we go after those? What are some of the driving forces behind where those jobs end up locating so that we can really address this goal?
Thank you.
Tom?
Yeah, thank you very much. So I'm wondering, following up on Supervisor Haggerty's question, is there ways to place financial incentives in order to redirect the traffic to different times? And if so, is anybody working on those around the country?
And Michael's actually very familiar with some of the night gates work that goes on down in Southern California. The Port of Oakland is exploring opportunities. They did a pilot a number of years ago that that they didn't continue because they were having problems with the financial viability of it. But they are looking at it again, and I think, you know, as we look at the trade-offs, I think the question will come up of what type of financial incentives do you need to make it work economically at the port, and is that something that we would identify as a priority investment to try to reduce those impacts that you see? And we'll talk about.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, the marine terminal operators at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach did institute a program several years ago. It's called the Pier Pass Off Peak Program, in which what they do is they impose a fee on every container that comes into the ports, and then there's a rebate on those that are picked up in the off-peak hours. And what they found when they instituted that program was that they had a significant shift of cargo, mostly out of the midday period, which is when a lot of that activity occurs, into the evening hours. There are some things, though, about that, and I think this is what the port really wants to look at, that I think we have to be careful about. One is the folks who dominate that shift are, of course, the largest importers who are already have 24-hour operations at their warehouses, and it's a little bit more difficult for some of the smaller shippers. And one of the things that we noticed in some follow-up work we did there, that there at least anecdotally appear to be cases where logistics service providers were picking up containers for some of those smaller shippers during the evening, holding them overnight, and then shipping them off to the shippers during the day, which I don't think is exactly what we want to encourage by doing that. So it's a challenging problem, but I think there's a lot of people that are interested in doing something along those lines.
Okay, yeah, hang on. May not be possible, but there could be some saying that just if you ship during the day, you're going to pay more. Just, you know, and then just try to restructure it some way that way, because I think that's what's going to work eventually, is where the dollars are.
Okay, Mark, Amy, and then.
I know with the airport on your team, you're going to hear this already, but I just wanted to check in. A lot of what we heard was the problem with particulate emission in those industrial corridors, and it just seems like natural gas fueling would be an obvious direction to go. Is there discussion around that, how to address that?
Yeah, there's actually, concurrent with the work that's going on at the regional level, CARB is doing a sustainable freight strategy that they are supposed to have a draft out this fall. And they're doing a lot of technology assessments as part of that. Their research division is leading a lot of research efforts. And so we are you know, participating in that to see what comes out of it, and anticipate that we'll do some additional research, but are hoping to see what they do first so that we don't duplicate efforts. There have been a few initiatives underway in Southern California that we're trying to see what lessons have been learned on. They have a couple of pilots underway.
Well, and also at the regional kickoff roundtable that we talked about, one of our panels is going to be focusing on innovative solutions, and we will be having a gentleman on that panel who will be talking about not just natural gas, but zero-emission technologies and what seems to be the place of those types of technologies in the goods movement sector.
Amy, then Jake.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for this summary report. It's really helpful to hear about the progress. And I just had a couple of questions. I know that we have several ports in the region, you know, we have the challenge, unlike many ports, where we are an import and an export port, which is wonderful for California. But I wanted to just talk about the, for example, you mentioned several that large elements. There's petroleum as well as automobile, and I know a lot of that impacts is in Contra Costa County and Solano. So is the Richmond port being engaged directly like the Oakland port? And the other thing I wanted to ask, I'll just ask the other question. Where, and I may be, probably it's included in the broad goals, but the whole, are we going to have some analysis of some of the infrastructure barriers to both safety, neighborhood compatibility, efficiency, you know, things like grade separations, things like, you know, I look at the Alameda Corridor as a, you know, as a model for freight movement that you know, eliminates the impact on slip streets and roads and passenger service and things like that. So just two of those questions moving forward.
Sure. I'll answer your second one first. We are going to be looking at, you know, all the different infrastructure solutions. We're hoping for both infrastructure, operational, and policy strategies. And we're using a lot of the projects that we already know about, as well as looking to see what other projects might be on the horizon to start integrating and looking at lessons like the Alameda Corridor to see what other parts of the country have done to provide solutions. In terms of the other ports, we are reaching out to the smaller, both seaports, as well as trying to get a little bit more airport participation to talk to them about their issues. They tend to have smaller staffs, and it's better if we go to them in sort of one-on-one meetings rather than asking them to participate in sort of quarterly group meetings. But we are going to be doing those meetings over the next few months. And Michael's done some work in Northern Contra Costa County, which we'll be presenting jointly actually at their board meeting next week.
Well, and also we are fortunate to be building on a good foundation of work that we just recently completed for Caltrans District 4. And one of the things that we did focus on in that was what were the needs of the smaller ports throughout the region. And I think one of the trends that we've seen is the potential for pretty significant growth in bulk export commodities, which are what those ports really deal in, and some interesting trends there. And we've identified already a series of investment needs that all of those ports have. So that'll definitely be addressed in this work as well.
Jake?
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jake McKenzie from Sonoma County and the Cities. Very quickly, has the Sonoma-Marin 101 corridor figured into your analyses?
Yes, it's one of the corridors we've identified as a major freight corridor, and we, as part of the District 4 work, as Michael mentioned, they did identify a number of infrastructure issues along that corridor, and we are actually just last week got a list of about 20 industrial businesses, agriculture and industrial businesses from Sonoma County that we're setting up stakeholder interviews with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this has been featured, you know, in the media over the last month or so, this question of tying in these businesses with freight service on smart tracks. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Ken Burkowski and Rich Hedges. Ken?
Hi, just a couple of comments. You know, Emeryville is just located just before the end of the line when you get into Oakland. And so we have these 100-car trains, and by the time they get to the end of the line, they're going like 5 miles an hour. So you have to imagine sitting at we have 3 at-grade rail crossings, so you have to imagine sitting at an at-grade rail crossing waiting for these trains to go by, so it creates traffic congestion. There's probably also inadequate warehousing. No community wants warehousing, so you have warehouses far away, so that means the truck's got to be on the road much more often to get to these remote warehouses. Truck parking is another major issue. We have a lot of trucks trying to park in the city, so as you regulate, they can't park here, they move there and every other place, so somebody needs to think about that. And then quiet zones. You know, they come through there in the middle of the night, they're blowing that horn, and those horns are really loud. You know, it's okay to have a few of them, but, you know, once they start becoming all the time, it could be a problem. Thank you.
Okay. Rich?
Thank you for allowing me to speak. At the risk of being a broken record, please consider the effects of the enlarging of the Panama Canal and that new, heavily subsidized port in Mexico, La Playa, Mexico, would be the largest deep water port in the United States, especially on the West Coast. Just a couple of headings from newspaper articles. China wins NAFTA superhighway battle, and they're emphasizing the port in Mexico. This port should be completely finished sometime by 2015. Kansas City Southern is pulling the freight through Mexico directly to Kansas City. They've already hired 7,000 warehouse people, are interviewing and hiring now in Kansas City. They're building a huge multimedia portal in Johnson County, which drives me nuts because they have the second large rail yards in the country in the inner city. Why they would go to new plow ground to do this. This is going to be a major impact, especially on Los Angeles, but will probably have some impact on us as well. Now, I noticed from some of the slides that it's actually the imports are to this port are a lower level somewhat than Long Beach, but still, we need to factor that in because it is going to be a factor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Committee members, any other comments? Okay. That's the end of our meeting. If no one has any other comments, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you. Good job.
Thank you.